Sierra. Snow in August. It had frightened Nassor, although Hooker said it had sometimes snowed in the Sierra before that day. They sat uncomfortably despite the hot tea and the warmth of the tent, despite the luxury of being dry, because they had too much to talk about and neither wanted to begin. They both knew they would have to make choices soon enough. Their camp was too close to the ruins that had been Bakersfield. In the ashes and wreckage of the city, there were a lot of people who might get it together, more than enough to come out and finish Nassor and Hooker. They hadn't got their shit together yet. The survivors lived in small groups, distrustful of each other, fighting over the scraps of food left in supermarkets and warehouses, the scraps that Hooker and Nassor had left. It came down to this. In combination, Alim and Hooker had enough men and ammunition to fight one good battle. If they won it, they'd have enough for another. If they lost, they were finished. And they'd stripped the country around them. They had to move. But where?
"Goddamn rain," Hooker muttered.
Alim sipped tea and nodded. If only the rain would stop. If Bakersfield dried out, there'd be no problem. Wait for a good day with strong winds. There were always strong winds, and burn out the whole goddamn city. 100 fires started a block apart would do it. Firestorm. It would sweep across and leave nothing behind. Bakersfield would no longer be a threat. And the rains were wearing down. There had been an hour of sunshine the day before. Today the sun was almost breaking through, and it wasn't noon yet, and there was only misty rain.
"We got 6 days," Hooker said. "Then we start getting hungry. We get hungry enough, we'll find something to eat, but..."
He didn't finish the sentence. He didn't have to. Alim shuddered. Sergeant Hooker saw Alim's expression, and his mouth twisted into a curl of evil contempt.
"You'll join in," Hooker said.
"I know." He shuddered again at the memory of the farmer Hooker had shot, and the smells of the stew, and the sharing out of portions of the man, everyone in the camp taking a bowl, and Hooker damned well seeing that they ate it. The ghastly ritual was what held the group together. Alim had to shoot one of the brothers who wouldn't eat. And Mabe. At least it did that. Their ritual feast let him shoot Mabe and get rid of that troublemaking cunt. She wouldn't eat.
"Funny you never did before," Hooker said.
Nassor said nothing, his expression not changing. The truth was they'd never even thought of eating people. Not one of them. It was a source of secret pride for Alim. His people weren't cannibals. Only, of course, they were, because that was the only way Hooker would let them join up.
"Lucky you had that beef jerky."
Hooker couldn't let it alone. Not now, not ever.
"You never got hungry enough. Lucky."
"Lucky. Lucky!" Alim's explosion startled Hooker. "Lucky my ass!" Alim shouted. "There was a ton of the stuff in that van, and we got maybe 2 pounds because of that motherfucker." He looked out through the open doorway of the tent toward a slim black man who stood guard near the fire. "That one. That motherfucking Hannibal." Hooker frowned.
"That why you make him do all the work? He lose you some food?"
Alim was wild with remembered rage and pain. "Food and liquor. Listen, we could smell it. It just about drove us crazy. You see the burns on Gay? We thought he was gonna die, and all of us got burned trying to..."
"What the fuck are you talking about?"
"Yeah, you don't know." Alim reached behind him to a footlocker and took out a bottle. Cheap whiskey from a drugstore. Thank God California had everything in drugstores. "We got together," Alim said. "Me and my people and some others. Back then... back when we didn't think..." He couldn't finish that sentence. "Before. All the honkies." Sergeant Hooker calmly leaned across the table and slapped Alim's face. Hard. Alim's hand went to his holster, but stopped. "Thanks," he said. Hooker nodded.
"Tell the story."
"The white people, the rich ones in Bel Air, about half of them took off. Left their places, left them empty. We took in trucks, and we went through those houses. He paused, a delighted smile playing on his lips as he thought of it.
And we were rich. That watch I gave you, and this ring.
He held the cat's eye to catch the light.
TVs, hi-fi, Persian rugs, real Persian, the kind the fences pay 20 big ones for. All kinds of fucking shit. Hook, we were rich.
Hooker nodded. Okay, he'd done worse. It still made him uncomfortable. Hooker had been a soldier. He could have been sent to Bel Air to shoot motherfucking looters.
Crazy world.
And we found a stash, Alim said.
Coke, hash oil, weed, nothing but the best. I took it away before my dudes could start lighting up right there.
Hooker drank whiskey.
Get it all?
Don't be so fucking smart. No, I did not get it all. I wasn't even trying, Hook. I just wanted to make the point. If they used on the spot, I'd take it off them. Hell, that was then, you know. There were cops on patrol all over.
Yeah.
So it happened. The goddamn hammer. We got out. Fire trails, roads, anything. We got out, heading for Grapevine, and the truck starts wheezing. We were out on one of the trails, trying to stay off the freeways, you know? So we come up on top of a rise and see this van coming behind us. Bright blue van with four bikes. Everybody with shotguns and rifles, like a stagecoach in the movies with the army riding escort.
Sure,
Hooker said. He poured more whiskey. In a few minutes, they'd have to talk for real, but it was nice to be dry, have a drink, not think about where they'd have to go now.
We set it up real good, Halim said. Got ahead of the van far enough. Used a chainsaw to drop a tree just as the van comes through a narrow place, and man, you should have seen it. Those bikes stopped, and my studs wasn't more than 5 feet from them. Come out from the trees shooting, used a lot of bullets, but shit, with those pistols we had. Anyway, it was perfect. Knocked the bikes over, never touched one of the bikes at all. There's the van stopped, and the driver's got his hands on the wheel where we can see, nice and easy. And the van's not even touched. Hook, not even a scratch on that pretty blue paint. And did I get all that coke we found in Bel Air? No, I did not. That motherfucking Hannibal was sniffing all along. And it was good stuff, you know? Real. Not the shit he used to get. But he sniffs 2-3 lines at a time. And those dudes are just opening up that van, coming out nice and easy, and Hannibal decides he's the last of the Mau Mau. He comes whooping up to the van with a Molotov cocktail. Shit! He threw that gasoline bomb right in the van. Right inside.
Ah, shit.
Hooker shook his head, thinking about it.
Good stuff in the van.
Good. Good. Hook, you won't believe what was in that fucking van. That motherfucker went up like...
gasoline.
Yeah, a lot like that.
Alim tried to laugh, but he couldn't.
The guys inside the van caught on fire and come out screaming, and a couple of the bastards have guns. I gotta give them credit. Clothes all burning up, they're still shooting at us, and we shoot back. And by the time that was over, the whole van's on fire. Can't get near it. Bottles start exploding in the truck. Oh, man, Hook, the smells were enough to drive you out of your gourd. Here we're starving, nothing to eat, and out comes cooking meat smells, and more. Scotch, brandy, fruity smells like those liqueurs that nobody ever has the bread for. Chocolate, raisins, apples. Shit, Hook, that van was stuffed with food and liquor. Food. Meat, not somebody in the truck. Beef.
Alim stopped suddenly. He looked sideways at Hooker. Hooker didn't have to say anything.
Yeah, anyway, something blew then. And out comes this package of beef jerky, still wrapped up in tinfoil and plastic bags. Not burned, no gasoline on it, couple of pounds of beef jerky. Gay runs into the truck and comes out with 2 bottles, only we had to let him drink one of them to kill the pain. And when he really started feeling it, we'd drunk the other. Shit. But a couple of the studs on the bike were still alive, and they told us what they had in that truck. Everything. Guns, food, every kind of liquor ever made.
European stuff. Can you imagine what it must be worth now? Europe can be on the fucking moon for all we'll ever see from there again. There was a ton of beef jerky, and fatty stuff that tasted even worse, only who cares when you're starving? And soup, and potatoes, and freeze-dried mountain food. Shit, those dudes had waited until the hammer came and looted all the places where they'd seen people getting ready.
Smarter than you were, Hooker said.
Alim shrugged. Maybe. I didn't think that fucking comet would hit, did you?
No.
If I had, Hooker thought, if I had, I'd never have been out in that truck. We'd have had a lot more ammo. Shit, why did I go off and leave the captain alone back there? Shit.
And bottles of gasoline, Alim was saying. Big help, right? We could smell it, all of it. Food burning, gasoline exploding, clothes burning. Those motherfuckers must have really thought the glaciers were coming. And if they were right, Nassor screamed, then that motherfucking Hannibal is going across them bare-ass, because I'll be wearing his clothes over mine.
What happened to the bikes?
Hooker asked. He didn't bother asking about their riders.
Got burned up. Fucking truck kept blowing. More gasoline in there. Spread all over.
Shit, Hooker, that fire was so fucking hot that it got the trees burning. In the middle of that rain, water coming down like a bathtub of warm shit, and even the trees get to burning. We saved their shotguns, though.
That's good. Too bad about the other stuff.
Yeah.
They were safe for a while, and just about everybody, even the slaves, was dry and warm and had almost enough to eat. They didn't want to think about leaving or where they'd go, and they'd put off talking about it before, and they put it off now, but they wouldn't be able to put it off much longer.
Alim! Sergeant!
It was Jackie. There were others yelling, too. Alim and Hooker ran out of the tent.
What is it?
Corporal of the Guard, post number 4,
someone yelled.
Let's go!
Hooker waved troops to their perimeter positions, then went off toward the yelling sentry.
Be not afraid, my brothers,
someone called from out in the misty rain.
I bring you peace and blessing.
Shitfire,
Sergeant Hooker said. He peered out into the mist. An apparition materialized. A man with long white hair and long white beard, and a raincoat that looked something like a gown or a ghost's winding sheet. There were other figures in the gloom behind the man.
Hold it right there, or we shoot!
Hooker yelled.
Peace be with you, brothers,
the man called. He turned back toward those who were following him.
Be not afraid. Stay here, and I will talk with these angels of the Lord.
A crazy, Hooker said. Lot of crazies.
He'd seen plenty of them before. He cocked the submachine gun. No point in letting the old goon get too close. But the man walked in steadily, not afraid at all, facing Hooker's gun and not afraid of it, and certainly there wasn't any threat in his eyes.
You need not fear me,
the man said.
What do you want?
Hooker demanded.
To talk with you, to bring you the message of the Lord God of hosts.
Ah, fuck that shit,
Hooker said. His finger tightened on the trigger, but now the old man was too close. Two of Hooker's own people were near enough to the line of fire that Hooker didn't want to risk it. And the man looked harmless enough. Maybe there'd be some fun in this. And what could it hurt to let him come in?
The rest of you stay out there,
Hooker yelled.
Gillings, get a squad and check them out.
Right, Gillings called. The white-haired man strode to the campfire as if he owned it. He looked into the stew pot and at the others around the fire.
Rejoice, he said. Your sins are forgiven.
Now just what do you want?
Hooker demanded.
And don't give me crap about angels and the Lord. Angels,
Hooker snorted.
But you can be angels,
the man said.
You were saved from the Holocaust. The hammer of God has fallen upon this wicked world, and you have been spared. Don't you want to know why?
Who are you? Alim Nassor demanded.
I am the Reverend Henry Armitage,
the man said.
A prophet. I know, at the moment I do not look much like a prophet of God. but I am, just the same.
Alim thought Armitage looked very much like a prophet, with his beard and white hair, and that long flowing raincoat and glittering eyes.
I know who you are, my brothers, Armitage said. I know what you have done, and I know it is not easy in your hearts. You have done all manner of sins. You have eaten forbidden foods. But the Lord of hosts will forgive you, for he has spared you to work his will. You are to be his angels, and to you nothing shall be forbidden.
You're crazy, Hooker said.
Am I? Armitage chuckled. Am I? Then you can listen for amusement. Surely a madman cannot harm you, and perhaps I will say something funny.
Alim felt Jackie come up alongside him.
He's good, that one, Jackie said. Notice how he's got the sisters listening, and us too.
Alim shrugged. There was a compelling quality about the man's voice, and the way he kept shifting from that preachy jive to just talk. That was good. Just when you thought he was nuts, he'd talk like anybody else.
What is this mission God has for us? Jackie called.
The hammer of God has fallen to destroy an evil world, Armitage said. An evil world! God gave us this earth and the fruits thereof, and we filled it with corruption. We divided mankind into nations, and within nations we divided men into rich and poor, black and white, and created ghettos for our brothers. And if any man has this world's goods, and sees his brother in want, and shares not with his brother, that man hath no life. The Lord gave this world's goods, and those who had them knew him not. They piled bricks upon bricks, they built their fancy houses and palaces, they covered the earth with the belch and stink of their factories, until the earth itself was a stench in the nostrils of God.
Amen, someone shouted.
And so his hammer came to punish the wicked, Armitage said. It fell, and the wicked died.
We're not dead, Alim Nassor said.
And yet you were wicked, Armitage answered. But we were all wicked, all of us. The Lord God Jehovah held us in the hollow of his hand. He judged us and found us wanting, and yet we live. Why? Why has he spared us?
Alim was silent now. He wanted to laugh, but he couldn't. This crazy old bastard. Nuts. Truly cracked, but yet...
He has spared us to do his work, Armitage said. To complete his work. I did not understand... In my pride, I believed that I knew. In my pride, I believed that I saw the day of judgment coming in the morning of the hammer. And so it was, but not as I believed. The scripture says, no man knoweth the day and the hour of judgment. And yet we have been judged. I thought upon this after the hammer fell. I had thought to see the angels of the Lord come to this earth, to see the King himself come in glory.
Vain, vain pride.
But now I know the truth. He has spared me, he has spared you, to work his will, to complete his work, and only when that work is done shall he come in glory. Join me, become angels of the Lord, and do his work, for the pride of man knoweth no end. Even now, my brothers, even now there are those who would bring back the evils the Lord God has destroyed. There are those who will build those stinking factories again, yea, who will restore Babylon. But it shall not be, for the Lord has his angels, and you shall be among them. Join me.
Alim poured whiskey into Hooker's cup.
You believe any of that, Jive? He asked.
Outside the tent, Henry Armitage was still preaching.
He sure do have a voice, Hooker said. 2 hours and he ain't slowing yet.
You believe? Alim asked again. Hooker shrugged.
Look, if I was a religious man, which I ain't, I'd say he talkin' sense. He do know his Bible.
Yeah, Alim sipped his whiskey. Angels of the Lord.
He was no goddamn angel, and he knew it. But the old son of a bitch kept twitching memories of storefront churches and prayer meetings, phrases that Alim heard when he was a kid, and it bothered him. Why the hell were they still alive? He leaned out the tent flap. "Jackie," he called.
"Right."
Jackie came in and took a seat. Jackie was all right. Jackie hadn't had any problems with Chick for a long time. He'd found a white girl, and she seemed to like Jackie a lot, and Jackie was pretty sharp now.
"What about that preacher man?" Alim asked.
Jackie waved both hands.
"He's making more sense than you think."
"How's that?"
Hooker asked.
"Well, some ways he's right," Jackie said. "Cities, rich people, way they treated us. He's not saying anything the Panthers didn't say. And damn it, that hammer did end all that shit. We got the revolution handed right to us. And what are we doing? We sitting around doing nothing, going nowhere."
"Shit, Jackie," Alim said. "You letting that honk..."
He bit the word off before Sergeant Hooker could react.
"That white preacher get to you?"
"He is white," Jackie said.
"And I wouldn't be the onlyest one.
You remember Jerry Owen?"
Alim frowned.
"Yeah."
"He out there, with the others that come with the preacher man."
Sergeant Hooker grunted.
"You mean that SLA cat?"
"Wasn't SLA," Jackie said. "Another outfit."
"New Brother Liberation Army," Alim Nassor said.
"Yeah, all right," Hooker said. "Called himself a general."
Hooker snorted contempt. He didn't like people who gave themselves military titles they hadn't earned. He was, by God, Sergeant Hooker, and he'd been a real sergeant in a real army.
"Where the hell he been?" Alim demanded. "FBI? Every pig outfit in the country wanted him."
Jackie shrugged.
"Hiding out, not far from here, valley up near Porterville. Hid out with a hippie commune."
"And now he's with the preacher man," Hooker demanded. "He believe that stuff?"
Jackie shrugged again.
"He say he do. Course, he always was into environmentalism. Maybe he just thinks he's found a good thing, 'cause the Reverend Henry Armitage has got himself a big following that do believe." "A big following. And he's a white man, and he preaches that blood don't matter. And those believers of his, they believe that too. You think about that, Sergeant Hooker. You think about that real good. I don't know if Henry Armitage is the prophet of God or crazy as a hoot owl. But I tell you this, there ain't going to be many big outfits left that'll let us be leaders."
"And Armitage
says you are the chief angel of the Lord," Jackie said. "He say your sins are forgiven, you and all of us. We're forgiven, and we gotta do God's work with you as chief angel."
Sergeant Hooker stared at them, wondering if they were falling under the spell of that ranting preacher, wondering if the preacher meant what he was saying. Hooker had never been a superstitious man, but he knew Captain Horror used to take the chaplains seriously. So did some of the other officers, ones that Hooker had admired. And,
"Damn it," Hooker thought. "Damn it, I don't know where we're going, and I don't know what we ought to do. And I do wonder if there's any reason for anything, if there's a reason we stayed alive."
He thought of the people they'd killed and eaten, and thought there had to be a purpose to it all. There had to be a reason. Armitage said there was a reason, that it was all right, all the things they'd done to stay alive. That was attractive, to think there'd been a purpose to it all.
"And he say, I'm his chief angel?"
Hooker demanded.
"Yes, Sarge," Jackie said. "Didn't you listen to him?"
"Not really,"
Hooker stood.
"But I'm sure as hell going to listen to him now."
6th week. The High Justice. No proposition is likelier to scandalize our contemporaries than this one. It is impossible to establish a just social order. Bertrand de Jouvenal, Sovereignty. Alvin Hardy made a final check. Everything was ready. The library, the great book-lined room where the senator held court, had been arranged and everything was in its place. Al went to tell the senator. Jellison was in the front room. He didn't look well. There was nothing Al could put his finger on, but the boss looked tired, overworked. Of course he was. Everyone worked too hard. But the senator had kept long hours in Washington, and he'd never looked this bad. "All set," Hardy said. "Right. Start," Jellison ordered. Al went outside. It wasn't raining. There was bright sunshine. Sometimes there were 2 hours of sunshine a day. The air was clear, and Hardy could see the snow on the peaks of the High Sierra. Snow in August. It seemed to be down to the 6,000-foot level yesterday. Today it was lower, after last night's storm. The snow was inexorably creeping toward the stronghold. "But we're getting ready for it," Hardy thought. From the porch of the big house he could see a dozen greenhouses, wood frames covered with plastic dropcloths found in a hardware store, each greenhouse covered with a web of nylon cord to keep the thin plastic from billowing in the wind. "They wouldn't last more than one season," Al thought, "but it's one season we're worried about." The area around the house was a beehive of activity. Men pushed wheelbarrows of manure, which was shoveled into pits in the greenhouses. As it rotted, it would give off heat, keeping the greenhouses warm in winter, they hoped. People would sleep in them, too, adding their own body heat to the rotting manure and grass clippings, anything to keep the growing plants warm enough, which seemed silly today in bright August sunshine, except that already there was a tinge of cold to the air as breezes came down from the mountains. And a lot of it was going to be wasted effort. They weren't used to hurricanes and tornadoes here in the valley, and no matter how hard they tried to place the greenhouses where they'd be sheltered from high winds, yet get enough sunshine, some of them would be blown down. "We're doing all we can," Hardy muttered. There was always more to do, and there were always things they hadn't thought of until too late. But it might be enough. It would be close, but they were going to live. "That's the good news," Hardy said to himself. "Now for the bad." A ragged group stood near the porch. Farmers with petitions. Refugees who'd managed to get inside the stronghold and wanted to plead for permanent status and had managed to talk Al, or Maureen, or Charlotte into getting them an appointment with the senator. Another group stood well apart from the petitioners. Armed farmhands guarding prisoners. Only 2 prisoners today. Al Hardy waved them all inside. They took their places in chairs set well away from the senator's desk. They left their weapons outside the room, all but Al Hardy and the ranchers Al knew were trustworthy. Al would have liked to search everyone who came to see the senator, and one day he'd do that. It would cause too much trouble just now. Which meant that 2 men with rifles, men Al completely trusted, stood in the next room and stared through small holes hidden among the bookshelves, rifles ready. Waste of good manpower, Al thought. And for what? Who cared what the others thought? Anybody in his right mind would know it was important to protect the senator. When they were all seated, Al went back to the living room. "Okay," he said. Then he went quickly to the kitchen. It was George Christopher himself today. One of the Christopher clan always attended. The others would go in and take the seat reserved for the Christopher representative and stand when the senator came into the room. But not George. George went in with the senator. Not quite as an equal, but not as someone who'd stand up when the senator came in. Al Hardy didn't speak to George. He didn't have to. The ritual was well established now. George followed Al out into the hall, his bull neck flaming red. Well, not really, Al admitted, but it ought to have been. George fell in with the senator, and they walked in together just after Al. Everyone stood. Al didn't have to say anything, which pleased him. He liked things to run the way they ought to, precisely, smoothly, without it seeming that Al Hardy had to do anything at all. Al went to his own desk. The papers were spread there. Across from Al's desk was an empty seat. It was reserved for the mayor, but he never came anymore. Got tired of the farce, Al thought. Hardy couldn't blame the man. At first, these trials were held in City Hall, which lent credibility to the pretense that the mayor and the chief of police were important. But now that the senator had given up wasting time going into town... "You may begin," Jellison said. The first part was easy. Rewards first. Two of Stretch Tallison's kids had devised a new kind of rat trap and caught 36 of the little marauders, as well as 12 ground squirrels. There were weekly prizes for the best rat catchers, some of the last candy bars in the world. Hardy looked at his papers, then he grimaced. The next case was going to be tougher. "Peter Bonar, hoarding," Al said. Bonar stood. He was about 30, maybe a little older. Thin blonde beard. Bonar's eyes were dulled. Hunger, probably. "Hoarding, eh?" Senator Jellison said.
"Hoarding what?"
"All kinds of stuff, Senator. 400 pounds of chicken feed, 20 bushels of seed corn, batteries, 2 cases of rifle cartridges. Probably other stuff that I don't know about."
Jellison looked grim.
"You do it?" he demanded. Bonar didn't answer.
"Did he?"
Jellison asked Hardy.
"Yes, sir."
"Any point in a trial?" Jellison asked. He looked directly at Bonar.
"Well?"
"Hell, he's got no call to come out and search my place. He had no warrant."
Jellison laughed.
"What beats me is how the hell they found out."
Al Hardy knew that. He had agents everywhere. Hardy spent a lot of time talking to people, and it wasn't hard. You catch someone and don't turn him in, send him out looking, and pretty soon you get more information.
"That's all you're worried about?" Jellison demanded. "How we found out?"
"It's my feed," Bonar said. "All that stuff is mine. We found it, my wife and I. Found it and carried it in my truck. And what the hell right do you have to it? My stuff on my land."
"Got any chickens?" Jellison asked.
"Yeah."
"How many?"
When Bonar didn't answer, Jellison looked to the others in the room.
"Well?"
"Maybe a few, Senator,"
one of those waiting said. She was a 40-year-old woman who looked 60.
4 or 5 hens and a rooster."
"You don't need any 400 pounds of feed," Jellison said reasonably.
"It's my feed,"
Bonar insisted.
"And seed corn. Here we'll have people starve so we can keep enough seed corn to get in a crop next year, and you've got 20 bushels hidden away. That's murder, Bonar. Murder.
Hey,
you know the rules. You make a find, you report it.
Hell, we won't take it all. We don't discourage enterprise, but you sure as hell report it so we can plan. And you grab half or more."
"Sure. Hell, there's no point in talk," Jellison said.
"Anybody want to speak for him?"
There was silence.
"Al?"
Hardy shrugged.
"He's got a wife and 2 kids, ages 11 and 13.
"That complicates things," Jellison said.
"Anybody want to speak up for them?"
"No."
There was an edge to his voice now.
"Hey, you can't. What the hell? Betty don't figure in this."
"She knew it was there," Jellison said.
"Well, the kids."
"Yeah, the kids."
"Second offense, Senator," Hardy said. "Gasoline last time."
"My gasoline on my land."
"You talk a lot," Jellison said. "Too damned much.
Hoarding. Last time we let you off easy. God damn it, there's only one way to convince people I mean what I say. George, you got anything to say?"
"No,"
Christopher said.
"The road," Jellison said. "By noon today. I'll leave it to Hardy to decide what you can take with you. Peter Bonar, you're for the road."
"Jesus, you got no right to throw me off my own land," Bonar shouted. "You leave me alone, we'll leave you alone. We don't need anything from you."
"The hell you say,"
George Christopher shouted.
"You already took our help. Food, greenhouses. We even gave you gasoline while you were holding out on us. The gasoline we gave you ran the truck that got that stuff for you."
"I think Brother Varley will look after the kids,"
one of the women said.
"Mrs. Bonar, too, if she can stay."
"She'll come with me,"
Bonar shouted.
"And the kids, too. You got no right to take my kids away from me."
Jellison sighed. Bonar was trying for sympathy, gambling that they wouldn't send his wife and kids out on the road, and since they couldn't take the kids away from Bonar... Could he? Jellison wondered. And leave a festering sore inside the stronghold. The kids would hate everyone here, and besides, family responsibility was important. As you will, Jellison said. Let them go with him, Al.
Jesus, have mercy!
Bonar yelled.
Please, for God's sake!
Jellison sounded very tired when he said,
See to it, Al, please, and we'll discuss who can be settled on that farm.
Yes, sir.
The boss hates this, Hardy thought. But what can he do? We can't jail people. We can't even feed what we have.
You rotten bastard!
Peter Bonar shouted.
You fat son of a bitch! I'll see you in hell!
Take him out, Al Hardy ordered.
Two of the armed ranch hands pushed Bonar out. The farmer was still cursing when he left. Hardy thought he heard blows when they got to the hall. He wasn't sure, but the curses stopped abruptly.
I'll see to the sentence, sir, Hardy said.
Thank you.
Next. Mrs. Darden, her son arrived from Los Angeles, wants to stay. Senator Jellison saw the tight line that formed where George Christopher's mouth had been. The senator sat straight in his high-backed chair, and he looked alert. Inside, he felt tired and defeated, but he couldn't give up. Not until next fall, he thought. Next fall, I can rest. There'll be a good harvest next fall. There has to be. One more year, it's all I ask. Please, Lord. At least this next one is simple. Old lady, no one to look after her, relative arrives. Her son is one of us, and George can't say different. That's in the rules. I wonder if we can feed him through the winter. The senator looked at the old lady, and he knew that whatever happened to her son, she would not survive until spring. And Arthur Jellison hated her for what she would eat before she died. Ninth Week. The Organization Man. One must point out, however, that many who now deplore the oppression, injustice, and intrinsic ugliness of life in a technically advanced and congested society will decide that things were better when they were worse. And they will discover that to do without the functions proper to the great systems, without telephone, electric light, car, letters, telegrams, is all very well for a week or so, but that it is not amusing as a way of life. Roberto Vaca, The Coming Dark Age. Harvey Randall had never worked so hard in his life. The field was filled with rocks, and they had to be moved. Some could be picked up and carried by one or two or a dozen men. Others had to be split apart with sledges. Then the pieces were carried away to be built into low stone walls. The crisscross pattern of low walls in New England and Southern Europe had always seemed charming and handsome. Until now, Harvey Randall hadn't realized just how much human misery each of those walls represented. They weren't built to be pretty, or to mark boundaries, or even to keep cattle and swine out of the fields. They were there because it was too much work to haul those stones completely out of the fields, and the fields had to be cleared. Most of the pasture land would be plowed for crops. Any crops, anything they had to plant. Barley, onions, wild grains that grew in ditches along the sides of the roads. Anything at all. Seeds were scarce. And worse, there was the decision to be made, plant for later or eat it now.
Like a goddamn prison,
Mark grumbled. Harvey swung the sledge. It rang against the steel wedge, and the rock split nicely. That felt good, and Harvey almost forgot the rumbling in his stomach. Heavy work, and not enough to eat. How long could they keep it up? The senator's people had worked out diet schedules, so many calories for so many hours of heavy work, and all the books said they had figured correctly, but Harvey's stomach didn't think so.
Making little ones out of big ones, Mark said. A hell of a job for an associate producer.
He grabbed an end of the piece they'd split off the rock as Harvey lifted the other end. They worked well together, no need for talk. They carried the rock to the wall. Harvey ran a practiced eye along the wall and pointed. The rock fit perfectly into the place he'd selected. Then they went for another. They stood idle for a few seconds, and Harvey looked across the field where a dozen others were splitting and carrying rocks to the low wall. It could have been a scene from hundreds of years before.
"John Adams," Harvey said.
"Eh?"
Mark made encouraging noises. Stories made the work go easier.
"Our second president of the United States,"
Harvey forced the wedge into a tiny crack in the rock.
"He went to Harvard. His father sold a field they called the Stony Acres to get up the tuition. Adams would rather be a lawyer than clear the stones out."
"Smart man," Mark said. He held the wedge in place as Harvey lifted the sledge.
"Not much left of Harvard now."
No. Harvard was gone, and Braintree, Massachusetts was gone, and the United States of America was gone, along with most of England. Would kids learn history now? But they have to, Harvey thought. One day we'll dig out of this, and there'll be a time when it's important whether we have a king or a president, and we'll have to do it right this time, so we can get off this goddamn planet before another hammer falls. Someday we'll be able to afford history. Until then, we'll think of England the way they used to think of Atlantis.
"Hey," Mark said, "look at that."
Harvey turned in time to see Alice Cox jump the big stallion over one of the low walls. She moved with the horse as a part of him, and again the impression of a centaur was very strong. It reminded Harvey of the first time he'd come to this ranch, a lifetime ago, a time when he could stand at the top of the big snailhead rock and at night talk about interstellar empires. That had been a long time ago, in another world, but this one wasn't so bad. They were clearing the fields, and they controlled their boundaries. No one was raped or murdered here, and if there wasn't as much to eat as Harvey would have liked, there was enough. Breaking rocks and building walls was hard work, but it was honest work. There weren't endless conferences on unimportant matters. There weren't deliberate frustrations, traffic jams, newspapers full of crime stories. This new and simpler world had its compensations. Alice Cox trotted up to them.
"Senator wants to see you up at the big house, Mr. Randall."
"Good." Harvey gratefully carried the sledge over to the wall and left it for someone else to use. He squinted up at the sun to estimate how much daylight was left, then called to Mark.
"You may as well go on back," he said. "You can put in the rest of the day on the cabin."
"Right." Mark waved cheerfully and started up the hill toward the small house where Harvey, the Hamners, Mark, and Joanna, and all four Waggoners lived. It was crowded, and they were building on extra rooms, but it was shelter, and there was enough to eat. It was survival. Harvey went the other way, downhill toward the senator's stone ranch house. It had additions built onto it, too. In one of them, Jellison kept the stronghold's armory, spare rifles, cartridges, two field artillery pieces, but no ammunition, that had been part of a National Guard training center before it was flooded out. Hand-loading equipment to reload shotgun shells and rifle cartridges, loot recovered from a gunsmith shop in Porterville. The dyes had been underwater and were rusty, but they still worked. Powder and primers had been sealed in tins that hadn't yet rusted through when they were recovered, although that had been a near thing, too. In another annex, the senator's son-in-law sat with a telegraph and radio. The telegraph at present ran only to the roadblock on the county road, and there was nothing coming in on the radio, but they had hopes of extending the telegraph lines. Besides, it gave Jack Turner something to do. He wasn't good for a lot else, and he did know Morse code. He might as well be a telephone orderly, Harvey thought. Turner's only attempt to supervise a ranch project had been a disaster, with the men finally going to the senator and demanding Turner's replacement. Turner hailed him as he went past.
"Hey, Randall."
"Hello, Jack. What's new?"
"We've got another president, Hector Shorey of Colorado Springs. He proclaims martial law."
Jack Turner seemed to think that was funny, and so did Harvey. He said,
"Everybody always proclaims martial law."
"Lippman didn't."
"Yeah, I liked Emperor Pro Tem Charles Avery Lippman.
even if he was getting most of his material out of Monty Python's Flying Circus. The others were too damn serious. Shorey's group sounds serious enough. I got some good recordings through the static.
Hold the fort, Jack, Harvey said, and he went on. Four presidents now, he thought. Littman was just a ham radio operator and half mad. But Colorado Springs, that was near Denver, a mile above sea level. That could be for real. The big front room was crowded. This was no ordinary meeting. The senator sat near the fireplace in the big leather armchair that reminded Harvey of a throne, and was probably meant to. Maureen sat on one side, and Al Hardy on the other, heiress and chief of staff. Mayor Seitz and the police chief were there, and Steve Cox, Jellison's ranch foreman, the man now responsible for most of the agriculture in the valley, and half a dozen others who spoke for the valley people. And, of course, George Christopher, alone in one corner, with only one vote, though it counted for as much as the rest together, except for Maureen's. Harvey smiled at Maureen. He got a quick, impersonal smile and nod. Nobody home. And he pulled his eyes away fast. Bloody hell. She wore two faces, and so did he. Maureen had been up to see him in the hut at the top of the ridge several times when Harvey had night guard duty. She'd met him at other times and places, too, but always very privately. It was always the same. They talked of the future, but never of their future, because she wouldn't. They made love with care and tenderness, as if they might never meet again. They made love, but never promises. She seemed to draw strength from him, as he knew he did from her, but never in public. It was as if Maureen had an armed, jealous, invisible husband. In public, she barely knew him. But in public, she treated George Christopher no differently. She was a bit more friendly, but still cold. He wasn't her invisible husband, was he? Was she different with him when they were alone? Harvey couldn't know. These thoughts ran through his head before an old reflex pushed them down below conscious thought. He didn't have time for them. Harvey Randall wanted something, and these were the men who could refuse him. It was a familiar situation. "Come in, Harvey." Senator Jellison had not lost the warm smile that had won him elections. "We can start now. Thank you all for coming. I thought it might be wise to get a full report on how things are here."
"Any reason for doing it now?"
George Christopher asked. Jellison's smile didn't falter.
"Yes, George. Several. We have word from the Telegraph that Deke Wilson's coming in for a visit. Brought some visitors, too."
"There's news from outside?" Mayor Seitz asked.
"Some," Jellison said. "Al, would you begin, please?"
Hardy took papers from his briefcase and began to read. How many acres cleared of rocks, and how much they'd be able to plant in winter wheat. Livestock inventory. Weapons and equipment. Most of the people in the room looked bored before Hardy finished.
"The upshot is," Hardy said, "that we'll make it through the winter. With luck."
That got their interest.
"It'll be close," Hardy warned. "We'll get damned hungry before spring. But we've got a chance. We've even got medical supplies. Not enough, but some. And Doc Valdemar's clinic is set up and running." Hardy paused for a moment. "Now for the bad news. Harvey Randall's people have been looking over the dams and powerhouses above here. They can't get them working again. Too much washed out. And out of the lists of stuff the engineering people have asked for, we don't have a quarter of the supplies. It'll be a while before we rebuild much of a civilization here." "Hell, we're civilized," Police Chief Hartman said. "Almost no crime. And we'll have enough to eat, and we've got a doctor and a clinic, and most of us have plumbing. What more do we need?"
"Electricity would be nice," Harvey Randall said.
"Sure, but we can live without it," Chief Hartman said. "God damn, we can live till spring."
And Harvey felt his joy. The journey to the stronghold had been a terrible time. The end of the world passing in endless agony. And, "God damn, listen to us now, talking like it isn't enough just to be alive. I could have been turned away, sent down the road."
"I think I would express thanks in a more positive way," Reverend Varley said. "We should be singing hosannas."
The minister's expression was grim, in contrast to his words.
"Of course, the cost has been high. Perhaps, Chief, you have said it correctly after all."
Senator Jellison cleared his throat to get their attention. The room fell silent.
"There's a bit more news," Jellison said. "We have a new claimant to the office of President of the United States, Hector Shorey."
"Who the devil is Hector Shorey?"
George Christopher demanded.
"Speaker of the House, newly selected by the party caucus. I don't even remember the House taking a formal vote. Still, his claim is the best we've heard, and the Colorado Springs government at least talks like it's still in charge of the country."
"I could do that myself," Christopher said.
The senator laughed. "No, George, you couldn't. I could."
"Who cares?" George Christopher was belligerent. "They can't help us and they can't jail us. They'd have to fight their way through all the other United States governments, and even then they can't get to us. Why do we give a damn what they say?"
Al Hardy said, "I point out that Colorado Springs probably has the largest military detachment surviving in this part of the world. The cadets at the academy, the NORAD, North American Air Defense Command under Cheyenne Mountain, Ent Air Force Base, and at least a regiment of mountain troops."
"They still can't get to us," Christopher insisted. "Understand, I've got nothing against getting the United States going again, but I want to know the cost. Will they tell us to pay taxes?"
Jellison nodded. "Good question." He looked around him.
"Whatever happens, it can wait till spring, can't it? Either we'll be out of the woods by then, or we'll be dead. Al says we won't be dead."
There were nods and murmurs of agreement.
"Now," Jellison said, "I asked Harvey to come to this meeting because he has a proposal. Harvey has asked for another expedition outside to get more equipment that we'll need for next spring."
He held up a paper that Harvey recognized as a list he and Brad Wagoner and Tim Hamner had prepared.
"Mostly things we won't need before spring."
"But perishable, Senator," Harvey said. "Electrical tools, transistors, components, electric motors. A lot of things that might still be useful even though they've been underwater. By spring, they won't be."
"We lost 4 good men the last time we went outside," George Christopher said. "It's bad out there."
"Because we didn't take enough men," Harvey answered. "We need to go in force. A big column won't be attacked." He was proud of his control. He didn't think anyone would guess from his voice how the thought of going out of this valley terrified him. He glanced at Maureen. She knew. She wasn't looking at him, but she knew.
"And we'll use a lot of gasoline," Al Hardy said, "as well as throw work schedules off. And you still might have to fight."
"Well, we take enough men, it might not be so bad," George Christopher said. "But I'm not going out with just a couple of trucks anymore. Harvey's right. If we go with a lot of people. 10 trucks, 50 to 100 men."
"I suppose we have to think of these things,"
Reverend Varley said. His voice was wistful and sad.
"Yes, sir,"
Christopher was determined.
"Reverend, I want peace as much as you do, but I don't know how to get it. Don't forget Deke's neighbors, the ones that got eaten."
Reverend Varley shuddered.
"I hadn't," he said.
There was a pause, and Harvey jumped in.
"Tim's worked with the phone book and maps," he said. "We've located a scuba shop. It shouldn't be under more than 10 feet of water. We could dive in there and get the scuba gear."
"What are you going to use for air?"
Steve Cox demanded.
"We can build a compressor," Harvey said. "That's not hard to design."
"Might not be hard to design, but without electricity it's going to be hard to build,"
Joe Henderson said. He had owned the filling station in town and was now helping Ray Christopher set up a blacksmith and a mechanic shop.
"Let me name some other things we need," Harvey said. "Machine tools, lathes, drill presses, all kinds of tools. And we've located most of them, on the map, that is. And we'll need them one day."
Henderson smiled wistfully.
"I could sure use some good tools," he said. "Generator wire," Harvey continued. "Bearings, spare parts for our transport vehicles, electrical wire."
"Stop," Henderson said.
I give up. Let's go out.
Al, could we spare 50 men for a week? Jellison asked. Hardy looked unhappy.
Eileen, he called. She came in from another room. Get me those manpower trade-offs, please.
Right.
She flashed Harvey one of her sunburst smiles before she left.
Eileen Hancock Hamner had been wrong. Good administrators were needed even after Hammerfall. Al Hardy often told the senator that she was the most useful person in the stronghold. Strong backs, farmers, riflemen, even mechanics and engineers weren't so hard to find. But someone who could coordinate all that effort was worth her weight in gold. Or in black pepper. Hardy scowled. He didn't like this expedition. It was an unnecessary risk. If Randall had his way... Was Randall still chasing the blue van and the men who had murdered his wife? At least he'd stopped talking about it.
While she's getting that, Chief Hartman said, let me put in a nickel's worth. We can spare 50 men for a week if nobody comes after us while they're gone. 50 men and rifles is a big part of our strength, Senator. I'd like to be sure nobody's going to attack us before I go along with sending that many out at once.
I can go along with that, Mayor Seitz said. And maybe we send a patrol out through Trouble Pass before we go, just to see if anybody's coming that way.
Harry's due back from a sweep in a day or so, Senator Jellison said. And Deke's coming within the hour. We'll find out what things are like outside before we make any final decisions. George, you got anything to say about this?
Christopher shook his head.
Either way suits me. If things aren't too bad out there, if there's nobody just waiting for us to send out a big party so they can jump us, then sure, we can go.
He fell silent and stared at the wall, and they all knew what he was thinking. George Christopher didn't want to know what went on outside. No one else did either. It just made things harder to know of the chaos and death and starvation a few miles away while they were safe in their valley. Eileen came back with papers. Hardy studied them for a while.
It all depends on what you find, he said. We need more fields cleared. We haven't got enough land cleared to plant all the winter seed. On the other hand, if you can find more materials to make greenhouses out of, we won't need so much land planted for the winter. Same for fertilizer and animal feed, if you can get those.
Then there's the gasoline.
It was gasoline and man-hours against a return that could only be guessed at. So they guessed, and they talked it around. And presently Senator Jellison said,
Harvey, you're proposing that we take a risk. Granted, it's a risk with a high payoff, and we don't lose much. But it's still a risk, and at the moment we don't need risks to stay alive.
Yes, that's about the size of it, Harvey said.
I think it's worth it. But I can't guarantee it.
He stopped for a moment and looked around the room. He liked these people. Even George Christopher was an honest man and a good one to have on your side if there was trouble.
Look, if it was left to me, I'd stay here forever. You can't imagine how good it felt to get into this valley, to feel safe after what we saw in Los Angeles. If I had my druthers, I'd never leave this valley again. But we do have to look ahead. Hardy says we'll get through the winter, and if he says so, we will. But after winter, there's spring, and the winter after that. And more years, years and years. And maybe it's worth some effort right now to make those future years easier.
Sure, provided it don't cost so much there aren't any more years, Mayor Seitz said. He laughed. You know, I was talking to that lady head doctor. Doc Ruth says it's a survivor syndrome. Everybody who lives through Hammerfall gets changed by it. Some go completely nuts, and life isn't worth a damn to them. They'll do anything. But most get like us, so cautious we jump at our shadows. I know I'm that way. I don't want to take any chances at all. Still, Harvey's got a point. There is a lot of stuff out there we could use. Maybe we'll even find Harv's...
Blue van!
Cried at least four men, and Hardy winced. Randall might have stopped talking about the blue van, but nobody else had. Black pepper, spices, beef jerky, pemmican, canned soup and canned ham, coffee, liquor and liqueurs, and a partridge in a pear tree.
Everything you could dream of, and all measured in ton lots. Machine tools, huh? If Hardy could read the minds of 50 men as they set out on this fool expedition, he knew what he would find. 50 images of a blue van just behind their eyes. Presently, Senator Jellison ended the meeting. "It's obvious we can't decide anything until Deke gets here to tell us what things are like out there. Let's wait for him."
"I'll see if Mrs. Cox has the tea," Al Hardy said. "Harvey, would you help me a minute, please?"
"Sure."
Harvey went out to the kitchen. Al Hardy was waiting for him.
"Actually," Hardy said, "Mrs. Cox knows what to do. I wanted a word with you. In the library, please."
He turned and led the way.
"Now what?" Harvey wondered.
It was obvious Hardy didn't care for the salvage expedition, but wasn't there something more? When Al Hardy ushered him into the big room and then closed the door, Harvey felt a familiar fear. Al Hardy liked things neat. There was an admiral Harvey had interviewed years ago. Harvey had been struck by the man's desk. It was absolutely symmetrical, the blotter precisely centered, the identical in and out baskets on either side, inkwell in the middle with a pen on either side, everything but the pencil the admiral was using to gesture. Harvey looked it over, and then he aimed the camera exactly down the middle of the desk, and he put the pencil right in front of him, in line with his tie tack. And the admiral loved it.
"Sit down, please," Hardy said. The assistant reached into a drawer of the senator's big desk and took out a bottle of bourbon.
"Drink?"
"Thanks."
Now Harvey was definitely worried.
Al Hardy held almost as much power as the senator. He executed the senator's commands. And Hardy liked things neat. He precisely matched the network executives who would order Randall to cut the man in the street crap and use motivational research, who would have found their jobs much easier if all men had been created not just equal, but identical.
Could it be a problem with Mark? And if so, could Harvey save him again? Mark had almost got himself thrown out of the stronghold. Hardy hadn't appreciated Mark's sign proclaiming the stronghold Senator Jellison's trading post and provisional government. Neither had George Christopher. They hadn't cared for the wasted paint, either. Maybe it wasn't Mark. If Al Hardy decided that Harvey Randall was upsetting his neat patterns, the stronghold couldn't survive without Hardy's mania for organization. The road was always there, and nobody ever forgot it. Harvey shifted nervously in the hard chair. Al Hardy sat across from him, pointedly not taking the big chair behind the desk. No one but the senator would ever sit there, if Al Hardy had any choice in the matter. He waved toward the big desk with its litter of paper. Maps with penciled lines showing the current shore of the San Joaquin Sea. Manpower assignments, inventories of food and equipment, anything they could locate, and another list of needed items they didn't have. Planting schedules, work details, all the paperwork associated with keeping too many people alive in a world suddenly turned hostile.
"Think all that's worth anything?" Al asked.
"It's worth a lot," Harvey said. "Organization, that's all that keeps us alive."
"Glad you think so."
Hardy raised his glass. "What shall we drink to?" Harvey waved toward the empty chair behind the desk.
"To the Duke of Silver Valley."
Al Hardy nodded. "I'll drink to that."
"Skoll." "Prosit."
"He is a duke, you know," Hardy said. "With the high, middle, and low justice." That knot of fear in Harvey's stomach began to grow.
"Tell me, Harvey, if he dies tomorrow, what becomes of us?" Hardy asked.
"Jesus, I don't even want to think about it."
The question had startled Harvey Randall.
"But there's not much chance of that."
"There's every chance," Hardy said. "I'm telling you a secret, of course. If you let it get out, or let him know I've told you, it won't be pleasant."
"So why tell me? And what's wrong with him?"
"Heart," Al said. "Bethesda people told him to take it easy. He was going to retire after this term, if he lived that long."
"That bad?"
"Bad enough. He could last 2 years, or he could die in an hour. More likely a year than an hour, but there's a chance of either."
"Jesus,
But why tell me?
Hardy didn't answer, not directly. You said it yourself. Organization is the key to survival. Without the senator, there'd have been no organization. Can you think of anyone who could govern here if he died tomorrow?
No, not now.
How about Colorado? Hardy asked. Harvey Randall laughed.
You heard them in there. Colorado can't keep us alive, but I know who would take over.
Who? You? Hardy shook his head. It wouldn't work. Two reasons. One, I'm not a local. They don't know me, and they take my orders only because they're his orders. Okay, in time I could get around that. But there's a better reason. I'm not the right man.
You seem to do all right.
No. I wanted his seat in the Senate, and he'd have arranged that for me when he retired. I would have been a good senator, I think, but not a good president. Harvey, a couple of weeks ago I had to go up to the Bonar place and evict his wife and two children. They cried and screamed and told me I was as much as killing them, and they were right. But I did it. Was that the right thing to do? I don't know, and yet I do know. I know because he ordered it, and what he orders is right. That's a strange character deficiency, Hardy said. I could go into my childhood in the Catholic orphanage, but you don't want to hear my life story. Take it from me. I do best when I've got someone else to lean on, somebody else to be the final authority. The old man knows that. There's not a chance in the world that he'd designate me as his successor.
So what will you do when...
I'll be chief of staff to whomever Senator Jellison designates. If he hasn't designated anyone, then to whoever I think will be able to carry on his work. This valley is his life work, you know. He's saved us all. Without him, it would be like outside here.
Harvey nodded. I expect you're right. And I like it here, he thought. It's safe, and I want to be safe.
What has all this got to do with me?
You're ruining things, Hardy said.
You know how. Harvey Randall's teeth clenched. If he dies tomorrow, Hardy said. If he does, the only person who could take over would be George Christopher. No, before you ask, I will not like being his chief of staff. But I'll do it, because nobody else could hold this valley. And I'll see that everyone knows that George is the senator's chosen heir. The wedding won't trail the funeral by more than a day.
She wouldn't marry George Christopher.
Yes, she will. If it means the difference between success and ruining everything the senator has tried to build, she'll do it.
You're saying that whoever marries Maureen ends up in charge of the stronghold?
No, Hardy said. He shook his head sadly. Not anybody. You couldn't, for example. You aren't local. Nobody would take orders from you. Oh, some would, if you were the senator's heir. But not enough. You haven't been here long enough. Al paused for a moment. It wouldn't work for me, either.
Harvey turned to stare at the younger man. You're in love with her, he said musingly.
Hardy shrugged. I think enough of her that I don't want to kill her. Which is what I would be doing if I married her. Anything that disorganizes this valley, that splits it into factions, will kill everyone here. We'll be a pushover for the first group that wants to come in. And, Harvey, there are enemies outside. Worse ones than you think.
You've heard something that wasn't told at the meeting.
You'll find out from Deke when he comes, Al said. He reached for the bottle and poured more bourbon into both their glasses. Stay away from her, Harvey. I know she's lonely, and I know how you feel about her, but stay away from her. All you can do is kill her and ruin everything her father has built.
Now, damn you, I...
It does no good to shout at me or be angry with me.
Hardy's voice was calm and determined.
You know I'm right. She must marry whoever will be the new duke. Otherwise, Jack Turner will try to assert his rights, and I will have to kill him. Otherwise, there will be factions who will try to take power because they will believe they have as much right as anyone does. The only possible chance for a peaceful transfer of power is to appeal to loyalty to the senator's memory. Maureen can do that. No one else can. But she cannot control everyone,
Together, Maureen and George will be able to. Finally, Hardy's icy calm broke, just slightly. His hand trembled. Do you think you are making things